The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the main story, The Sweet Life. TBJ's 22 CEO and C-suite honorees offer advice for new executives and strategies for winning talent in a tight labor market. And this special section is within the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, CEO of the Year and C-Suite Awards. Our 22 honorees address their biggest challenges, advice for new execs, and strategies for winning talent. First, we'll read the list of winners, and then we'll read one of them as an example. Jennifer Allen, CEPI. Allison Breeding, Aptio. Harry Chalker, PMC Commercial Interiors. Anthony Diamio, Bioventus, Brian Denisar, Bobbitt, Jose Domingos, Accreditation Commission for Healthcare, Miles Fitch, Fitch Lumber Company, Mickey Foster, First Health of the Carolinas, Robin Gordon, MetLife, Kim Jansen, SPCA of Wake County, Samantha Carr, MERS Aesthetics, George Kiefer, Huber USA, Dean Mitchell, Enact Mortgage Insurance, Cassia Nell Stewart, Laura Nicholson, Humacite, Jim Pack, Coastal Credit Union, Rance Poehler, Toshiba Global Commerce Solutions, Jonathan Savage, Trialcard, Ruth Sleater, Sonos, Mary Kay Wells, Pearson PLC, Jason Wyden, Raleigh Founded, and Erkang Zhang, Jupiter One. And these are not in any particular order, so we'll just read the first one. Jennifer Allen, Chief Strategy Officer, CEPI Incorporated, City of Birth, Charlotte. Family, husband Rob, daughter Emma. Education, BA English, NC State University. Company description, founded as a civil infrastructure, planning, design, and construction consultancy. We are planners, designers, surveyors, environmental scientists, landscape architects, construction inspectors, and more. How is your role important to the success of your organization? My role was created approximately 4 years ago to emphasize the importance of strategy across the organization, especially as CEPI began to grow, diversify, and expand into new markets and geography. As the company celebrated 20 years, it became clear that processes and procedures required a greater level of discipline in the areas of pursuit management, client experience, brand, and corporate social responsibility and philanthropy. What was your greatest professional achievement in the past year? Graduating from the Leadership North Carolina program. What's the greatest challenge you faced in your career? Realizing success as a female executive within non-traditional fields and markets. What civic organizations are you involved with? Raleigh Chamber of Commerce, State Capital Foundation, Dogwood State Bank, Leukemia Lymphoma Society, Women of the Year candidate, Downtown Raleigh Alliance, Frankie Lemon Foundation, Construction Management Association of America, NC Economic Development Association, and Urban Land Institute. Who do you consider to be your mentor and why? CEPI Saidi, founder and CEO of CEPI Incorporated, is a great mentor to me personally and professionally. She offers consistent, open feedback to me and every member of our leadership team. She is a fair, empowering, and empathetic leader I strive to emulate. She has created a culture and space where I and so many others thrive and flourish each and every day. Who would you most like to invite to a business lunch? A few of my favorite writers, thought leaders, Melinda Gates, Paul Coelho, Thich Nhat Hanh, and Pat Conroy. What's a key lesson you've learned along the way? Be courageous in your communication and conversations. Trust and empower others. Champion diversity of thought and never lose your sense of humor. What do you do to relax? Read and exercise. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by Managing Editor Dane Huffman. Former POTUS shares stories. Former President George W. Bush gave some lively remarks from the last conversation he had with his mother to meeting the Queen's Corgis in a Friends of Scouting luncheon that honored Raleigh businessman O. Temple Sloan, Jr. Sloan, who founded General Parts in 1961 and sold it for $2 billion to Advance Auto Parts in 2013, was awarded the Good Scout Lifetime Achievement Award. He called it the honor of a lifetime, and spoke passionately about the role of scouting at a time of broken homes, issues at schools, and out-of-control drug abuse at all levels of society, that's in quotes, highlighting the event, which drew thousands of people to PNC Arena as a fundraiser for the Scouts of the Okinichi Council, was a conversation with Bush led by Bob Ingram, a general partner at Hatteras Venture Partners. Bush said he enjoyed being out of the spotlight, and note-taking, recordings, and photographs were not allowed. Bush praised how he learned to set priorities from his father, President George H.W. Bush, and that how his father made time for his family despite his responsibilities. He said he called his mother, Barbara, just before she died in 2018, and her last words to him were, "You're my favorite son," on the phone, and that was also in quotes. He joked about how Queen Elizabeth once offered him tea, which he didn't really want but agreed to drink, and said he asked if he could see her corgis. She obliged, and soon corgis were bouncing around the room. Asked if he missed the White House, Bush laughed and said only that he missed the desserts. UNC's Cancer Center gets new name. North Carolina's State Cancer Hospital has a new name. UNC Health announced September 19 that the 315,000-square-foot facility has taken on the name of former State Senator Mark Bassnight, who passed away in 2020. Bassnight played an instrumental role in securing $180 million from the General Assembly in 2004 for what's now known as the North Carolina Bassnight Cancer Hospital. The late senator pushed for the hospital after experiencing firsthand the state's need for better cancer research and healthcare facilities as his wife, Sandy Bassnight, underwent treatment for leukemia. Sandy died 2 years before the hospital opened. When the facility opened in 2009, it tripled the space available in the state for cancer treatment. The hospital has more than 270,000 outpatient visits each year and is the clinical home for the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Meredith opens new building. Meredith College has a new building for the first time since 2009. The Women's College debuted its new $4.5 million Communication, Health, Exercise, and Sports Science building on September 8. CHESS houses instructional space for the growing communication and exercise and sports science programs and Meredith athletic offices. The project was completed in July, the first time Meredith has opened a building since the Oaks Student Apartments debuted in 2009. The school, with 1,600 undergraduates, has renovated multiple spaces in recent years, including Johnson Hall in 2016. Two Triangle developments get awards. Two housing developments, one in Raleigh and one in Durham, received awards for affordable housing. The 2022 Housing North Carolina Awards for Excellence in Affordable Housing were given to three developers and one organization. Two of those developments were in the Triangle area, East College Park in Raleigh and Willard Street Apartments in Durham. East College Park in Raleigh is a mixed-income community started by the City of Raleigh in 2017 to address the need for affordable housing. Willard Street Apartments in downtown Durham is an affordable mixed-use apartment community for working families completed in 2021. It was developed by DHIC Incorporated and Self Help Ventures Fund. ACC's new home has Raleigh connection. To the surprise of almost nobody, the Atlantic Coast Conference, or the ACC, has announced it will move its headquarters to Charlotte. The Queen City has been at the top of the list of potential sites ever since the conference started floating the idea of leaving its home in Greensboro, where it's been based for almost 70 years. Raleigh was one of the sites briefly under consideration, and even though the City of Oaks didn't win the grand prize, there is a local connection to the ACC's new home. The conference's new offices will be located in Uptown Charlotte at Legacy Union's Bank of America Tower, which is owned by Raleigh-based Highwoods Properties. The Real Estate Investment Trust paid more than $430 million for the 33-story, 841,000-square-foot building when it re-entered the Charlotte market in 2019. And finally, food company coming to town. SunTree Snack Foods, based in Phoenix, is creating 94 jobs in Wayne County. The governor's office announced this month the company is investing $10.1 million to create a manufacturing facility in Goldsboro. The site is being referred to as the East Coast headquarters for the company. The new jobs will pay about $50,700, and the company is in line for $250,000 in incentives from North Carolina if it meets certain job creation and investment thresholds. And now we'll move to some of the top news stories in the Triangle Business Journal. Downtown South adds elite concert venue to lineup. This is written by Kaylee Thompson. Plans for the Downtown South development in Raleigh just turned up the volume. Kane Realty Corporation unveiled new plans to include a concert venue for the entertainment district in the multi-billion-dollar development that's set to transform the southern gateway to the city. The Raleigh real estate developer will build a 70,000-square-foot venue to be operated by AEG Presents, the live entertainment division of Los Angeles-based Anschutz Entertainment Group. "We are incredibly excited to be bringing a new venue to Raleigh, and downtown South feels like a natural fit," said Sean Trell, AEG Presents Executive Vice President, COO, and General Counsel. The concert venue will have a 3,500-capacity main ballroom, a rooftop lounge, and event space. Construction is set to start in spring 2023, with a grand opening anticipated for fall 2024. An estimated cost for the project was not immediately made available. The venue will be designed to accommodate indoor shows of multiple sizes, both seated and standing, and will also be available for private events. Plans for Downtown South's first phase, located between South Saunders and South Wilmington Streets at Interstate 40, currently includes several buildings. In May, Kane revealed plans for two high-rise towers, one multifamily and one for office, while other plans call for two mid-rise mixed-use towers. The mid-size concert venue would provide the missing link for entertainment acts in Raleigh, says Josie Reeves, director of design for Kane Realty. "It will create more options for nightly entertainment, as AEG is responsible for a lot of big acts, festivals, and more. They've promoted tours for global artists such as the Rolling Stones, Taylor Swift, and Elton John. The company's festivals and multi-day music events include the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival and the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, as well as British Summertime at Hyde Park, Stagecoach, and the Hangout Festival." And our next article, written by Laura Brumette, the headline, "Raleigh CEPI sells to KC Engineering Firm. The acquisition is following along an industry pattern." A 20-year-old engineering firm started by CEPI Saidi, a well-known Raleigh entrepreneur, is now in the hands of a large Kansas City engineering and architectural planning firm. Saidi decided to sell her namesake company to private equity-backed Trans Systems, a company with more than 1,000 workers and more than $250 million in revenue. The deal was finalized on September 20. Founded in 2001, CEPI has grown a reputation in the Triangle as a multidisciplinary engineering firm and is ranked as one of the biggest outfits in the area with almost $40 million in annual sales. Saidi made the decision at the start of this year to sell the company due to the strength of the economy at the time and the company's growth trajectory, she says. CEPI will operate under the name CEPI, a division of Trans Systems, for a few years before fully transitioning to the Trans Systems name. Saidi says the 330 CEPI employees will continue to maintain their positions as she helps integrate the operations of two large companies. Following the transition, Saidi will assume the position of an advisor to the Trans Systems Board of Directors. Saidi owned about 90% of CEPI and will now be investing a large sum in Trans Systems. She will be one of the company's top shareholders, Trans Systems CEO Richard Morshus says. "With CEPI, we found that we're able to connect better with our clients, and that's really why we did it," he says. "With their culture of being open, honest, positive, and growing, and ours with serving and having a culture of caring, I think we can build better relationships with our clients and the communities that we serve." Saidi said she believes the marriage will continue to spread the corporate culture she has professed for the past two decades. "We feel very good about this transaction because we feel that it's not only protecting all of our employees and protecting their jobs, but also providing a tremendous growth opportunity for our staff," Saidi says. "Trans Systems has a larger footprint, and their geographic diversification creates a lot of opportunity for our staff." Trans Systems focuses on engineering and architectural planning, design and construction solutions in transportation and infrastructure. The company was recently acquired by a private equity firm in a move to accelerate the growth of Trans Systems. Often, private equity firms roll up several companies to build scale before selling operations to a bigger company or having an exit through an initial public offering. Though architecture and engineering firms were not commonly sought out by private equity in years past, 2021 saw a trend toward professional services acquisitions. The industry's lack of physical assets typically deterred private equity, but many engineering and architecture firms survived the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic unscathed and poised for growth, making them prime targets. Trans Systems was at the front of that trend in early 2021. The firm sold to Sentinel Capital Partners, a private equity group that agreed to recapitalize the business. At the end of 2021, TransSystems saw revenue of about $256 million. Besides its own acquisition by Sentinel, the firm also completed two other acquisitions last year. When the trend started, we were right there, the trailblazer as I see it, Morshis says. Our culture has been mergers and acquisitions, and so private equity has really helped as a partner in creating the financial model that has worked to make a combination like this happen. We feel really good that we're still privately held. That activity is on par with the firm's history. TransSystems was founded in 1966 in Kansas City and has since experienced a plethora of mergers and acquisitions. Over the past 30 years, TransSystems has done over 35 M&A deals, Morshis says. The CEPI acquisition, though, is the largest yet. Morshis declined to disclose the financial terms of the deal, but said the value was based on CEPI's EBITDA performance. The company also was also impressed with CEPI's geographic footprint of services and its culture. In 2021, CEPI recorded annual revenue of $37 million, according to Triangle Business Journal research. CEPI was ranked among the top 500 U.S.-based firms by the Engineering News Record, landing at spot number 408. TransSystems was ranked at number 77. Combined, TransSystems will now have around 1,400 total employees. The company will continue on its acquisition spree moving forward, Morshis says. A $1 trillion federal infrastructure bill, along with local initiatives and transportation, means interest from private equity isn't slowing down. Prior to the deal, TransSystems had a small presence in Charlotte, but nowhere else in the state. All nine CEPI offices will remain in operation. No changes will be made at CEPI offices, and the company is currently hiring for its Raleigh location. CEPI's headquarters is in the Block 83 development in downtown Raleigh. Other locations include Wilmington, Charlotte, Asheville, Charleston, South Carolina, and Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Since CEPI's founding, Saidi has become a leading example for minority business owners in the Triangle community. She was named the 2018 Business Person of the Year by TBJ. The new advisory role is exactly what she was looking for, she said. It's very exciting because it allows me to be a part of the growth of the company, strategic decisions, and to share my experience and my input, Saidi says. But also, I don't have to have the responsibilities that I've had for so many years. It's very exciting to have more of an advisory role and less of the responsibility. Encoded Therapeutics launches new site. Google-backed firm launches Mooresville manufacturing facility. This is written by Zach Ezone. A California-based gene therapy company is launching a new manufacturing site in Mooresville as it prepares to move its lead product into clinical trials. Encoded Therapeutics has officially opened its manufacturing facility on Perimeter Park Drive, which represents the company's first expansion outside of San Francisco. Encoded is focused on developing genetic medicines for disorders that affect the central nervous system. CEO Kartik Ramamoorthy co-founded the company in 2015 with Stephanie Tagliatella, Encoded's chief scientific officer. Since then, it has grown to just under 200 employees, including 15 in Mooresville, but the local site could grow to 50 to 60 employees. Since its founding, the company has built one clinical, regulatory, and now manufacturing capabilities that enable Encoded to take an idea from discovery all the way through to the clinic. Encoded has completed a series of raises, the last of which was $135 million, around closed in 2020, and was led by GV, formerly Google Ventures, the venture capital and investment arm of Google parent Alphabet Incorporated. The company's lead gene therapy program is for a rare disorder called Dravet syndrome. Ramamoorthy says Encoded plans to move this program into clinical trials next year. The initial clinical effort will be supported by third-party contract development and manufacturing organizations with the goal of eventually using the Mooresville site to supply material for future clinical studies. The pace of our discovery and the scale of our demand is putting us in a position where we don't want to bottleneck our innovation by being dependent on external groups, he says. Raleigh OK's Seaboard Station development. This is written by Kaylee Thompson. A large development at the site of the Seaboard train station is moving forward after the Raleigh City Council approved a rezoning request for the downtown property. The approval comes with conditions that would severely limit development options if the train station is not preserved. On September 20, Council voted 6-1 to approve a request from the property owner, Turnbridge Equities, allowing the developer to build up to 20 stories on the nearly 3-acre site at 707 Seamart Drive. Turnbridge bought the property currently home to Logan's Garden Shop for $8.5 million. The rezoning requires that Turnbridge preserve at least 50% of the current building, including the option to have the building relocated. If the building is not preserved, development height on the property would be limited to 7 stories, essentially ending the company's plans for the site. Phase 1 of the plan calls for a 16-story building roughly where the station is currently located. Phase 2 would include a 20-story tower. The two towers would be wrapped by development and thus cover a large parking deck from public view. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Healthcare and Higher Education page written by Zach Ezone. The main headline, UNC loses business school's Shackelford, Dean abruptly retires without replacement. After nearly a decade in the role, Doug Shackelford has suddenly stepped down as the dean of the UNC Kenan Flagler Business School. Shackelford's abrupt retirement became effective September 19, following the university announcing the move 3 days earlier. A specific reason for the timing of the decision was not given. The change leaves one of the top business schools in the country leaderless for the time being. UNC said an interim dean would soon be named ahead of a national search for a permanent replacement. Shackelford took over as dean in January 2014. Doug's tenure at UNC Kenan Flagler is marked by numerous achievements that leave the school in a position of strength. UNC Chancellor Kevin Guskowitz said in announcing Shackelford's departure. Shackelford's retirement comes a few weeks after a former UNC student, Angelica Rose Brown, filed a lawsuit against 3 Kenan Flagler professors and the UNC Board of Governors alleging race discrimination and retaliation. Shackelford is not mentioned in the lawsuit, which was filed August 30 in the U.S. District Court for North Carolina's Middle District. Shackelford oversaw a period of growth and record enrollment. Kenan Flagler has about 800 students total in its undergraduate business program, but the demand is much higher. The school is expected this year to begin construction on a $150 million expansion project to meet the needs of existing students and pave the way for future growth. The project includes the construction of a new facility and renovations to the school's existing home, the McCall Building. Kenan Flagler is growing in other ways as well. This fall, the school began the first semester of a new executive MBA program based in Charlotte. This is the business school's first expansion outside of Chapel Hill. Shackelford's departure follows other shakeups at the dean level over the year. UNC Chapel Hill began this semester with 7 new deans, one of which is the head of the new School of Data Science and Society. The others replaced academic leaders who stepped down or retired from their roles. North Carolina Hospital Group proposes con reform compromise. There may be a compromise on Medicaid expansion after all. The North Carolina Healthcare Association, which represents the state's hospital system, sent a proposal September 16 to state officials that includes some concessions from the group intended to spur a compromise with lawmakers. During the summer, both the State House and Senate proposed bills that would expand Medicaid access, but lawmakers couldn't agree on certain details. The association applauded the bill's inclusion of Medicaid expansion but opposed the changes to the state's CON law or CON law. However, in its recent proposal to state lawmakers, the healthcare association suggests certain reforms, including a repeal of CON requirements for chemical dependency and psychiatric beds. Additionally, the group proposes exempting operating rooms in ambulatory surgical centers that meet specific criteria. Morrisville drug maker eyes sale, merger. With limited cash and 2 late-stage clinical programs, a Morrisville pharmaceutical company could soon be looking for a buyer. Tenax Therapeutics announced on September 15 its plans to explore a range of strategic options, including a sale, merger, or other transaction to drive shareholder value. The company's share price dropped below $1 in early January and has remained in penny stock territory. The decision follows the company's quarterly report in August, showing Tenax needs additional financing to fund its planned operations beyond the fourth quarter. And now we turn to On Greater Triangle Growth, the page written by Evan Hoopfer. Dean Penny bets big on Clayton with 270 acres. JOCO mixed-use development eyes expansion to 4 million square feet. One of the largest mixed-use developments in Johnston County is quadrupling in size. The development team behind the Copper District in Clayton says that plans for the project have ballooned in the past few months. The project, which started out at about 70 acres, will now encompass about 270 acres, and that number has the potential to grow. Development will be based on how market conditions evolve over the coming years, but Dean Perry, senior project executive at Craig Davis Properties, envisions Copper District totaling about 4 million square feet or more of space between housing, commercial, retail, office, etc. The dramatic increase in scope of Copper District vaults the project into not only one of the largest mixed-use projects in Johnston County, but the entire triangle. So how did this happen? After the Clayton Town Council approved the rezoning last year for Copper District, Penny and his team started meeting with adjacent property owners. In the course of those conversations, I would always ask, what do you think about it? Is this something that you like and want to stay, or would you prefer to sell? Penny says. Quite honestly, there were a couple of really key landowners behind the farm that ultimately said, you know, we think we would prefer to sell. And that started the dominoes rolling. Work is already beginning on some of the newly acquired land. Plans for one section call for up to 360 multifamily units. Another section calls for up to 375 single family homes. Those sections are currently making their way through the Clayton rezoning process, and the development team hopes to have those proposals in front of the Clayton Town Council later this year. Another section will be an extension of the original 70-acre Copper District and will include ground floor commercial with office and more residential units on top. Penny referenced having a Main Street type vibe to this section. Demand for new homes fuels 77-acre purchase. Preston Development Company, based in Cary, purchased 77 acres in Chatham County for nearly $2.7 million, according to a deed filed August 30. The property sits adjacent to the northern portion of Chatham Park, a sprawling development set to include 22,000 homes and 22 million square feet of commercial space at full build-out. The company is still considering how to develop it, says Vanessa Jenkins, executive vice president at Preston. We're working on plans for what the housing would look like, Jenkins says. A rezoning will be necessary for the property. Jenkins added that a firm decision has not been made, but it's most likely the land will not be added to the Chatham Park Planned Development District, or PDD. The land could support dozens or hundreds of additional homes, depending on how Preston opts to develop it. Developer turns gaze from Durham. Southbury Development, based in Pinehurst, purchased 86.13 acres in Roxborough for $905,000, according to a deed filed September 7. David Chapman, who leads Southbury Development, says the land will be developed for 190 single-family homes, with prices starting in the 300,000s. He says that he's partnering with D.R. Horton, which will build the homes. The prices have gotten pretty astronomical in Durham County, he says. Person in places like Vance and Granville, people can get more house for their money. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Kaylee Thompson. Diocese wants to sell Morgan Street parcel. A hot property in downtown Raleigh just went up for sale. A little more than half an acre in a hot part of downtown Raleigh just went up for sale. The Diocese of North Carolina is selling its downtown Raleigh property at 200 West Morgan Street after using it for their offices since 2005. There is no list price for the property, as JLL, who is overseeing the sale, is open to fielding offers, according to Bishop Sam Rodman. The assessed value of the property and building is $5.9 million. The diocese purchased the property for $2.75 million in 2007. Downtown properties have been landing big price tags in recent years. The circular Holiday Inn building at 320 Hillsborough Street sold to a New York developer for $19.8 million in late 2021. A block south of the diocese, Greg Haddam, founder and managing partner of Empire Properties, acquired the professional building at the corner of West Harget and South McDowell Streets in an $11 million deal earlier this year. The 0.66-acre site at 200 West Morgan Street is zoned for up to 20 stories and has no parking minimums. The three-story, 20,600-square-foot building located next to Campbell University Law School is in the Capital District and a block away from the North Carolina State Capitol and within walking distance to parks, entertainment, restaurants, and shopping. The property is in a development hotspot. The new 301 Hillsborough Tower is on an adjacent block, and plans call for the nearby Holiday Inn property to be transformed into a 20-story development with high-end residences, a luxury hotel, and restaurant and retail space. The diocese decided to sell the property after transitioning to remote work and seeing that development opportunities downtown have created a heated real estate market. What we discovered during the pandemic is that despite not being in our usual offices, our productivity not only held to its usual levels, but increased, Rodman says. For 2 years, we have demonstrated we could continue to serve our churches in every way without a central office. Investment group maps 600-plus new apartments. A Dallas-based real estate developer and investment company is betting on continued growth in Morrisville with plans for hundreds of new apartments. Leon Capital Group has submitted new site plans with the town of Morrisville for two multifamily communities totaling more than 600 units off Airport Boulevard and McCrimmon Parkway. Morrisville 1.0 is proposed to be a mixed-use development on 16.25 acres. Site plans indicate there will be 350 one-, two-, and three-bedroom units spread across eight buildings. Seven buildings will be three stories and one will be four stories. Morrisville 2.0 sits on 17 acres. Site plans show six buildings of three and four stories with 315 apartments. Total. The units will be a mix of one, two, and three bedrooms. Leon Capital Group did not respond to a request for comment from Triangle Business Journal. And in Holly Springs, new homes, apartments proposed. Hundreds of new apartments and homes could be coming to fast-growing Holly Springs. Shenandoah Homes, a Raleigh-based home builder, has filed a rezoning request for 1100 Piney Grove Wilbon Road to change it to neighborhood mixed-use conditional use, according to Holly Springs records. The 36.2 acres south of town and west of Fuquay-Varina is currently zoned rural residential. Shenandoah Homes wants to develop a mixed-use neighborhood that would include mixed housing, retail, and a daycare. Proposed plans indicate there would be up to 183 units, a mix of apartments, townhomes, and single-family homes. And now we turn to the On Retail and Restaurants page, written by Laura Bromet. Logan's Garden eyes expanding operations. Longtime Raleigh business plants new seeds for growth. Located in the historic Seaboard train station in downtown Raleigh since 1991, Logan's Garden Shop has plans for a new home. The locally owned garden center has served the Raleigh community and beyond for 60 years. Now that new development is coming to the center's historic train station spot, the Logan's team is eyeing a larger lot in southwest Raleigh for its new location. The group purchased a vacant lot at 4020 Tryon Road in February for $3.9 million. The 6.61 acre lot is about twice the size of the Seaboard station location. And owner Joshua Logan is hoping to put a total of 19,850 square feet of space across two buildings, city filings show. Logan is expecting adjustments to the filed site plans to be made as the team works through the process with the city. Between city processes and slowdowns in the construction industry, the team does not have a specific timeline or delivery date in place for the new project. Beyond the Tryon Road lot, Logan's is looking to expand into other areas around the Triangle. We feel like the opportunity is there to grow pretty much in all directions throughout the Triangle area, Logan says. I don't imagine us growing much beyond the greater Triangle area in the near term, but we are actively looking at opportunities in other locations. As far as downtown Raleigh is concerned, Logan isn't ruling out that quite yet. At the time of the Seaboard station sale, the group did not find a property that matched the company's current needs within the downtown footprint, he says. But that doesn't mean downtown will be without a Logan store forever. Downtown has been very good to us. We would love to have some kind of presence downtown and offer some of the things that are most relevant to the types of living spaces in downtown, not necessarily a full-scale garden center, Logan says. The Seaboard Cafe, a beloved eatery located inside the current Logan's, will not be moving with the garden center. The cafe's owner, Rick Perales, is planning to retire. Southern Pines Brewing plans multi-million-dollar expansion, new tap rooms. Southern Pines Brewing Company is moving into Fayetteville, as well as establishing the first brewery in Carthage. The Fayetteville spot will be at 123 Hay Street. The 13,000-square-foot tap room will be three stories and offer a food menu. The spot is expected to open between July and September of 2023. Owner Micah Neubauer is in the process of purchasing the Tyson & Jones Buggy Factory building in Carthage. The historic property housed one of the South's largest carriage manufacturers in the 1800s. The town of Carthage purchased the building for $46,000 in 2015, named the Buggy Factory by Southern Pines Brewing Company. The location will serve beer and pizza. North Hills loses longtime restaurant. A sign posted on the entrance to Midtown Grill announced the spot's closure effective September 13. Located in North Hills, the restaurant served contemporary American cuisine in an upscale atmosphere for nearly 17 years. The eatery is owned by local businessman Doyle Parrish and Stephen Bullock. Summit Hospitality Group, a hotel group led by Parrish, manages the restaurant. The note posted on the restaurant's door says, "To all of our wonderful guests, it has been a pleasure to have served you for all of these years, but it is with heavy hearts that we are officially closing Midtown Grill effective 9/13/2022. Thank you for all the great times and great memories." And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to our continuing series, 52 Shades of Success, Earth and Equity. The headline is Sustainability Quotient: How Green Places Works to Give Companies Actionable Data to Determine Carbon Footprints. And stories by Connie Gentry. About this project, the Earth and Equity Project explores the growing awareness, actions, and accountability of businesses and leaders who face opportunities and challenges relating to environmental, social, and governance, ESG, issues. The 52-week project will highlight what selected companies and Triangle executives are doing to address climate change, diversity, equity, inclusion, and ways to maneuver the new world of corporate responsibilities. It's time to sweat the small stuff, at least when it comes to ESG reporting. From a big picture perspective, every business is hyper aware of the need to make decisions that are more sustainable, that put the company on that net zero journey to more positive outcomes for the environment. But virtually no one has a clue, much less an actionable sustainability strategy for how to get there from here. That's where Green Places steps in. With a fully automated platform that aggregates actual data across countless disparate resources to provide businesses with visibility into what their carbon footprint entails, where they need to make changes, and how to prioritize improvements. What Alex Lassiter, founder and CEO of Green Places, consistently hears from prospective clients is that they genuinely want to be more sustainable, but they don't know where to start. This is especially true for mid-sized to large businesses, those with 500 to 10,000 employees, that are large enough to have awareness and a sense of urgency about addressing sustainability, but that don't have internal teams tackling the issues. "The first thing we do with every company is establish their carbon footprint," Lassiter says. "You can't do anything without having full visibility into where you are. You can't make sustainable choices unless you know what a sustainable choice is. So the first step for everybody is to get that visibility." Green Places, which only took its platform live 9 months ago, is approaching the market with a focus on specific verticals, intent on providing critical recommendations and insights tailored to the tech, hospitality, and professional services industries. "We're seeing a lot of demand in the tech sector because a lot of tech companies really care about this," Lassiter says. "In recent months, interest from professional services companies like law firms, accounting firms, and financial services institutions has grown considerably. I think it's become a must-have for these firms, and if you'd asked me a year ago if I thought restaurants were going to care about this solution, I'd have said no, and I was, like, super wrong." In fact, major restaurant chains, including Taco Bell, Ben & Jerry's, Just Salad, and Subway, have joined the Green Places Advisory Board. The juxtaposition of simplicity and scalability across the platform make it an ideal resource for corporations with national, even global, footprints. "We sync with all of the utility platforms so we can track a company's energy usage, water usage, gas use, all of it, and benchmark things like the worst to best energy use per square foot or anomalies where water use is spiking," Lassiter says. Green Places also tracks energy efficiency across appliances like the fryers and refrigerators in commercial kitchens, as well as the energy ratings on HVAC systems. No detail is too minuscule to measure, not when it comes to where companies invest their sustainability dollars or the need for investor-grade ESG reporting. Lasseter tells the story of a client wanting to make a capital allocation for energy-efficient equipment who came in the door saying, "We've got money to spend. Where do we put it?" The contest came down to a property in Colorado or one in Connecticut. Because Green Places was synced with the energy grid in both locations, they could see that the energy usage per square foot was essentially the same. What was different was the environmental integrity of the two grids. One of the offices was pulling from a dirtier grid, meaning it had a higher amount of coal or lower amount of renewable energy, so we were able to tell them to put that money where it would matter the most, he says. In this case, the Colorado grid was much worse, so they advised the client to invest in that office, where there was a greater need for improvement and a greater opportunity to impact energy efficiency. That degree of specificity and actionable data adds credence to a company's ESG report, totally negating any misperception of greenwashing. Increasingly, investment decisions are being swayed by a company's accomplishments or lack thereof relative to ESG. Ernst & Young reported at the end of last year that 1 in 5 investors had chosen not to make an investment because of inadequate ESG policies. Similarly, a recent study from London-based Aon Investments concluded that real estate lenders will increasingly deny projects with poor ESG credentials. "The structured credit market is fully embracing ESG," reported Aon's managing director, Khalid Khan. "Although there is still much work to do here and the industry needs to safeguard itself against claims of greenwashing, real estate projects with poor ESG credentials will increasingly face issues accessing finance, resulting in limited options and punitive borrowing terms." What Green Places clients ask for most are benchmarking measures. They want to know if they're doing something well or falling behind others in the industry. "Most want to be perceived positively, but in a factual way. They're afraid of greenwashing," Lasseter says. Building their clients' credibility hinges on the expertise that Green Places has built in its core verticals, where it offers guidance tailored to the industry as well as the company's specific data based on its footprint. "If you're a software company, we're going to connect with all the tools that you use and then give you a playbook tailored for a software company," explains Lasseter, likening Green Places to other tailored platforms like Mint or Credit Karma. "These companies take universal strategies or vertical-specific strategies along with personal data and give guidance for what you should be doing, and that becomes very powerful and actionable for people." And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. The headline, "Homeowners, HOAs, on a collision course." If every homeowner in this country was asked if they like having a renter as their neighbor, the supermajority of the homeowners would say they would prefer a neighbor who owns the house. Behavioral researchers who have studied these things say having people as neighbors with skin in the game offers neighborhoods a sense of continuity, security, and community that eclipses almost any other wants. And perhaps the most important thing of all, homeowners feel having renters in their neighborhood diminishes the overall property values of the neighborhood. But America's changing, and changing fast. That's because of skyrocketing rental prices. While home prices have stabilized somewhat from their runaway appreciation for most of 2021 and 2022, rental rates continue to rise at an unprecedented rate. From Austin, Texas, to Raleigh and Phoenix, to Nashville, finding a one-bedroom apartment that is not a micro-unit for under $1,500 monthly rent is improbable. For most parts of the nation, those same rents fetched $1,000 or $1,100 monthly rent just 3 years ago. Now, homeowners who wanted to sell their property only to see their asking price receive a lukewarm response are resorting to the next option, rent. Today's rental rates, for the most part, could provide a homeowner with mortgage coverage, upkeep costs, and even some leftover cash. With ownership costs covered and a slowing housing market, homeowners across the country better get ready to welcome new neighbors. If this trend continues or accelerates, there's one group that may soon voice its concerns: homeowners associations, also known as HOAs. An HOA is run by a board of directors that is elected by homeowners to oversee the common assets of a property or area, manage its finances, run business affairs, enforce and set rules, and see to the maintenance and upkeep of the area. Many HOAs have rental restrictions. These restrictions are geared toward the very thing homeowners in that neighborhood did not want in the past: temporary neighbors who rent property, who may not follow the neighborhood covenants, and who are gone at the end of the lease agreement. HOA covenant varies from state to state and neighborhood to neighborhood, but almost all of the covenants are geared toward the protection of homeowners' rights and rules and to protect the entire neighborhood, whether it be property value, safety, or aesthetics. California and Florida have a mechanism to regulate HOAs for what lawmakers call a protection for the broader community of homeowners. In the past, lawsuits have flown against the HOAs, whether it be for an owner's right to make his or her house an Airbnb rental or a yearly rental. And these lawsuits are about to spread far and wide. Tina Pace, a Raleigh attorney specializing in HOA, says she has reworked 20 different HOA covenants in the past few months, just in the Raleigh-Durham area. This could get contentious, as most homeowners probably do not know the HOA covenants, she says. This phenomenon could eventually see rental rates come down in various markets as rental inventory increases, thanks to single-family homes for rent. CoreLogic estimates rents from single-family homes rose 13.4% year-over-year in July, after rising about 14% year-over-year a quarter ago. There's too much money out there, making many think this is the right time to cash in some of the gains and still continue to own the house and get the tax breaks. But the biggest roadblock may come in the form of their own HOAs, neighbors, and their community. And also on the Viewpoint page, we have a column from John Hood, who is a John Locke Foundation board member in Raleigh. The headline, "Should Today's Teens Be Optimistic?" The North Carolina of my childhood had an economy very different from that of the average state. When I started my first paid job in 1979, teaching four-year-olds how to tap dance, manufacturing accounted for a full one-third of North Carolina's gross domestic product, 10 points higher than the national average of 23%. On the other hand, our financial sector had not yet vaulted into national significance. Banking, insurance, and real estate accounted for 11% of North Carolina's GDP in 1979 versus the national average of 15%. 40 years later, in 2019, our state's manufacturing base was still larger than that of the average state, 16% versus 11%. That's the last year for which a clear comparison is possible. The onset of COVID-19 skewed the 2020 figures. If you work out the ratios, you'll see that the relative contribution of manufacturing to GDP in North Carolina and in the nation as a whole didn't change much. But the actual shares of GDP are much lower. That's not because manufacturing cratered. Output went up significantly. What really happened is that service industries exploded. Look at the aforementioned financial sector. Banking, insurance, and real estate now account for 21% of the country's GDP. North Carolina's proportion is the same. To broaden the story, North Carolina is more populous and prosperous than it was then. In 1979, some 5.8 million lived here. Their average personal income was an inflation-adjusted $26,665. By 2019, our population totaled 10.5 million and personal income averaged $48,261. Over those four decades, then, North Carolina's per capita income rose about 81% in real terms, somewhat outpacing the regional 77% and national 71% averages. I think these statistics are useful for level setting. They are difficult to square with the extreme claims of partisan activists, professional boosters, or professional worry warts. For example, North Carolina has not seen its manufacturing base disappear or the formerly sunny prospects of its working people fade into depressing dusk. Mainstay industries such as textiles, apparel, and furniture did shed lots of employees, primarily because of technology-fueled gains in productivity, not trade deals. But other manufacturing enterprises began or expanded in our state during the same period, as did many other sectors that hire many people to make, sell, or deliver many wonderful goods and services. On the other hand, it is also true that North Carolina has not always outperformed the rest of the Southeast or United States over the past 40 years, that some parts of our state are clearly struggling, and that our progress remains hampered by a long list of problems. They include educational deficits, infrastructure woes, legal and regulatory impediments, family formation declines, violent crime increases, and rampant substance abuse. Some of these problems are worse than they were back then. Some are better. When I was a teenager of modest means in 1979, however, I was largely unaware of broader social conditions. I thought primarily and optimistically about my own future and that of my peers. I figured we'd live more comfortable lives than our parents or grandparents had. I figured I'd find a fulfilling career that paid enough to support my future family, though even then I suspected that career might not be tap dancing. Are today's teenagers so optimistic? Should they be? And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Executive Voice Q&A column. This one is on Denise Sherd Bennett. The headline, she's breaking ground yet again. Longtime local banker Denise Bennett leads an Arkansas bank's push to enter Raleigh. Interview by Lauren Onasorge. Denise Sherd Bennett has done it all. She has churned out copies of bank statements for customers at UCB, now Truist. She was a teller at First Investors Savings and Loan, now First Citizens Bank. And for years, she served as Raleigh Market President for Wells Fargo. Now, she has a completely new challenge as the Triangle Market President for Arkansas-based Encore Bank. But why leave a steady job for a boutique bank that has little name recognition in the region? Because life is nothing without risk. That's what makes life so rewarding, she says. I've always put my life preserver on and navigated forward. In a Q&A, she talks about what drives her and how the industry can attract more female banking executives. What is your biggest professional accomplishment? Having navigated the commercial and private banking world with many firsts, women, woman, and African American, coupled with raising three incredible young men and pouring into others by advocating, sponsoring, and mentoring many others along the way. What's been your biggest career hurdle? In primarily all my roles in the financial world, I was either the first female, the first black, or the first black female, with the underlying premise that I shouldn't be there. I overcame the pressure with the mindset of breathing through tough moments and enjoying the trailblazer ride. Staying true to who I am gave me the courage, fortitude, and authenticity to ignore the naysayers. Due to my strong foundation of strong men and women in our family, a no-excuses attitude resulted in a higher trajectory. What made you want to take a risk on a new opportunity? Everything that I've done in my financial career has prepared me for such a time as this. This season of being able to join a bank with the opportunity to be an investor owner and participate in a future liquidity event was a no-brainer. I've participated in many bank mergers but was never afforded the opportunity to profit from them. How can the industry attract more women? We can attract more women to banking through education and awareness, being intentional about understanding and providing what women want from their workplace and spotlighting female role models within the banking industry. Women make up 52% of the employees at Encore Bank. A major part of our success in recruiting and retaining women is our focus on creating a positive workplace culture, particularly the fact that we offer our employees a flexible work environment, including opportunities to work a hybrid, remote, or an all-remote schedule. This is a tremendous recruitment tool for women who have caregiving responsibilities at home. Proactively preparing women for their next role is key also. Sponsoring women to push themselves outside of their comfort zones builds confidence to aspire for greater heights. What advice do you have for young women considering careers in banking and finance? Be your authentic self. There's no substitute for hard work. Integrity is everything. Relationships over transactions. Ask what you want because a closed mouth never gets fed. Learn valuable life lessons from every experience. Go for the next position even if you don't feel like you have all the qualifications. What's your personal motto? Go and stay where you're celebrated, not tolerated. Life is such a precious gift, with every season providing valuable lessons to catapult us to the next season. If you're not being celebrated, it's time to reassess. This is life-changing both personally and corporately. What's the best piece of career advice you've ever received? You can't be pitiful and powerful at the same time. My great-grandfather, Willie Shaw, the most brilliant sixth-grade educated person I ever met. Obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty with the current macroeconomic environment. What are you hearing from customers? We have heard some concerns about the economic environment, interest rate volatility, and the housing and real estate markets, but our clients have remained relatively upbeat. Our role in helping clients navigate economic uncertainty is to foster strong relationships with them, to understand their financial goals, and proactively anticipate their future and strategic goals and needs. Through our concierge approach to banking, we know our clients well, and we maintain consistent communication with them. This level of partnership and flexibility provides our clients and partners an extra sense of security. What's your go-to spot for a business lunch? We're fortunate in the Triangle to have fabulous eateries. I love Capital Grill. What book should every banker read? Start with Why by Simon Sinek. What inspires you? Jesus, Barack and Michelle Obama, and Oprah Winfrey. What was your first job? Working in tobacco. The best life skills and work ethic that you can ever glean from, and the best motivation to go to college. And now we'll read some of the big and notable numbers in the Triangle Business Journal. Number 10, that's where Duke University ranked among all schools in the country in the new 2022-23 rankings from U.S. News and World Report. Meanwhile, in the list of top national public schools, UNC Chapel Hill landed at number 5, and NC State University landed at number 29. 37,900. The number of new jobs that have been announced in the Carolina Core, a roughly 120-mile corridor stretching from just west of Winston-Salem down to the Fayetteville area during the last 4 years. $79 million, the amount Mill Creek Residential paid for its first acquisition in the Triangle area. Alistair Lake Lynn, formerly the Mark Apartments, went for $253,205 per unit. The property was previously sold in 2018 for $46.6 million. $42 million. That's the price that a large retail center on the northern edge of Wake County fetched last month. Wake Forest Crossing Shopping Center, anchored by the likes of Kohl's and Lowe's Foods, was sold by a New York firm to a local group. And finally, in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Business Pulse Survey. The question, how has inflation impacted you the most? The total number of responses were 255. Cost of food and groceries, 70%. Cost of doing business, 13%. Higher gas prices, 12%. And travel expenses came in at only 5%. And we'll wrap it up there as we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. 832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.